The month of November 2003 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The exact date, of course, November 22nd. And we might have thought that by now we knew everything there was to know, in that there must have been hundreds, I suppose a few thousand books, referring one way or another to and helping to explain aspects of the assassination. But that isn't quite the case, because most of what we know, or much of what we know, begins with what was in the Warren Commission report. And it turns out that there was a lot that might have been in that report that did not show up. I say all of this because we're about to talk with Philip Sheehan, who is a veteran New York Times correspondent in the Washington Bureau for many years, and the author of a new book titled A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And your very title comes from the Warren Report itself, doesn't it?
Right from the introduction, right, the first sentence. And the first sentence is that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was a cruel and shocking act against a man, a family, a nation, and against all mankind.
And within a few days after the assassination, the newly installed president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, activates a commission that will investigate it all and tell us how it really happened, who was really guilty, et cetera, et cetera. And he asked the Chief Justice of the United States to head that investigation. Apparently, Earl Warren was not eager to take the job.
Oh, he absolutely rejected the idea when it was first brought to him. He thought it was a terrible conflict of interest. Among other things, he was very close to the Kennedy family. He really adored John Kennedy. I think he thought it would just be too painful to be involved. And there had been a long history and a bad history of Supreme Court justices being involved in outside investigations. And among his colleagues, Warren had made it very clear that he thought it was wrong for them to take outside appointments like this. So he turns it down flat, but within hours of turning it down, he is summoned to the Oval Office, where he is confronted by the new president, President Johnson, a man he really doesn't know. And he is told that unless he takes the job, unless Earl Warren takes the job, the nation may face nuclear war. And Johnson puts it as bluntly as that, do you want to be responsible for World War III? Apparently the confrontation leaves Warren in tears, and he gives in. He accepts the job, even though he absolutely does not want it.
How did Johnson make that case, that if Warren didn't accept the assignment, that might lead to nuclear war?
Well, it wasn't such a crazy thought, because, of course, if at that point, this is only 7 days after the assassination, this encounter occurs, and, you know, there were rumors everywhere, conspiracy theories everywhere, that the Russians or the Cubans were somehow behind this. And if there was any truth in that, you know, obviously killing a president is an act of war, so you might well be on the path to Armageddon. And, of course, if the investigation was mishandled and allegations were made based on little evidence against the Russians or the Cubans, you might also find yourself on the path to nuclear war.
There's so much in this book of yours, but we should make clear first that it's based upon your investigation through interviews with, I suppose, dozens and dozens of staff members at the Warren Commission, now established senior lawyers, in those days very young people just out of law school, who did the major work for the commission.
Well, you know, I got involved in this book because in 2008 the phone rang at my desk in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, mm-hmm. and it was a very prominent American lawyer who said, he noted that I had just published my first book, which was a history of the 9/11 Commission. He was admiring of it, and he said, wouldn't I like to write a similar history of the Warren Commission, because he had begun his own career almost half a century earlier on the Warren Commission, and he said he would help me. He would introduce me to the other young staff members from the Warren Commission who are still alive, and I thought it was a pretty tantalizing offer. By the time I got involved, all of the members of the Warren Commission had passed on, but many of the then young staff lawyers who really did the digging of the Warren Commission were still alive, and I'm very grateful they were willing to talk to me.
You know, a Shakespearean line comes inevitably to mind. Hamlet, dying, says to his buddy Horatio, Horatio, report my cause aright to the unsatisfied.
There you go.
And a lot of these people who were staff members felt that much that happened at and to and through the Warren Commission was not generally known and should be known. And indeed, they're not all dying right now, but they're getting older, and they wanted their cause to be reported or right to the unsatisfied. And with regard to the assassination, we have all remained unsatisfied over these last 50 years, I think.
I think most of these lawyers, and they were all lawyers who talked to me, they were personally very proud of their role in the Warren Commission. They thought they had done a good job, and I think they were all pained by how much controversy there is over the Warren Commission findings, even though I think over the course of my conversations with them, I was able to point out to them for the first time some of the really essential flaws in the Warren Commission investigation.
The essential flaw, and you make a good deal of this quite appropriately, I would say, is the coverage or the failure to properly cover and treat and examine a crucial trip to Mexico City undertaken by a young man temporarily from Texas, namely Oswald.
I have to admit, going into this book, I really, you know, I thought I kept my ears open during my American history classes and in high school and college, but I don't remember hearing anything about Oswald's very mysterious trip to Mexico City. And it's sort of for me, it's sort of a missing chapter, or it had been a missing chapter of the saga of the assassination and the aftermath. But several weeks before the assassination, Oswald goes to Mexico City, apparently to get visas and paperwork that will allow him to defect to Cuba, much as he had attempted to defect to Russia in 1959. And while he's in Mexico City, he has encounters with Cuban spies and Russian spies and Mexican civilians who are very sympathetic to Castro's revolution. And these people at the height of the Cold War, you would think that some of them might have welcomed the opportunity to end the Kennedy administration and even perhaps to see President Kennedy dead. And it's very clear to me, and I think the record shows, that the FBI and the CIA were very determined not to get to the bottom of what happened in Mexico City, because an aggressive investigation would have shown, would have documented, demonstrated just how much the CIA and the FBI had really known about Oswald before the assassination and what a threat he might pose to John Kennedy.
Well, that's what you assert, and you make that case quite persuasively. You demonstrate that a good deal of the CIA knowledge was never properly transferred and turned over to the Warren Commission, and that there are missing documents from both the CIA and the FBI. And it remains to me still somewhat unaccountable as to why they did not originally go to government, go to the Oval Office or any place else to say there's a guy out there who really has the intent to murder the president, and here's what we have to do. That was not undertaken at all, neither by the CIA, which was headed at that time by Allen Dulles, am I right?
Well, no, at that time it was headed by John McCone.
John McCone. And the FBI, of course, was headed eternally by J. Edgar Hoover.
Absolutely.
So why didn't they act upon the information that they had?
Well, it may be, you know, government ineptitude, incompetence. You know, other people have alleged there may be something more sinister in all this, but it is just remarkable to realize, and I think this is very much in opposition to what had been the official story, but that, you know, the CIA and the FBI knew that Oswald had taken this trip to Mexico City at a time when he was already under surveillance by the FBI and had been under surveillance for months. He goes to Mexico City. He has these meetings at the Cuban and the Russian embassies, and his meetings there bring him under surveillance by the CIA station in Mexico City and apparently pretty aggressive surveillance. And the CIA knows, and this is September, October 1963, that among the other people this young fellow has met is a KGB officer working at the Soviet embassy whose specialty is political violence, political assassinations. You know, that meeting may have been entirely innocent because this KGB officer also had regular diplomatic duties. But just the fact that this young man, already under surveillance by the FBI as a national security threat, comes under surveillance by the CIA and is meeting with a KGB officer responsible for assassinations, you would think that would create alarm at those two agencies and that the Dallas field office of the FBI might be notified that a man living in Dallas by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald might have very violent it might have a plot to harm political figures, including John Kennedy, then in the final stages of planning for a trip to Dallas.
Well, was the fellow in Dallas, that is, the CIA operative in Dallas, or the FBI operative, were they informed of this at all?
They were not. They knew almost none of this. And I think they believe, and they came to believe, that had they known any of that, they would have been able to foil the assassination. And beyond that, towards the end of my book, there's a description of what happens at the FBI in the 1970s. After Hoover dies, his successor is a man by the name of Clarence Kelly. Mm-hmm. And Clarence Kelly, like millions of Americans, is perplexed in the 1970s about the many mysteries of the Kennedy assassination. And now he's the director of the FBI, so he has the opportunity to go back and review all the raw files from 1963 and 1964 about Oswald. And Kelly, after reviewing all this material, says very bluntly to friends and eventually writes that he was certain that there was more than enough evidence to show that Oswald was a threat in November 1963. And if somebody had just shared any of what was in the FBI and CIA files in Washington in 1963 with the Dallas field office, the assassination would have been prevented, and it might have been prevented easily.
In what year did Oswald return from Russia, or rather from the Soviet Union?
1962.
Just the year before.
Right.
And wasn't he under surveillance by FBI and or CIA all the way through?
There may be a brief period when he's not, but essentially after he returns home to the United States in 62, he is under surveillance mostly throughout. And then, as I say, he comes under what may have been pretty aggressive surveillance by the CIA when he goes to Mexico City in September 1963, you know, just 2 months before the assassination.
Listen to this quotation. I won't tell you for a moment who is the author. It would certainly be interesting to know what the CIA knew about Oswald 6 weeks before the assassination. But the contents of this particular message never reached the Warren Commission and remain a complete mystery. Can you guess who that is?
There are several candidates. I'd be intrigued to know who it is.
It's Jim Garrison,
who had
the view that there was a big plot. He had a lot of other people involved in it who apparently had nothing to do with it. But he had the view that basically the thing was motivated by the Cubans and that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting for or with them in the assassination.
Well, let's be clear about Garrison, though. Garrison had many, many different suspects in the assassination.
To be sure, yeah.
And they changed, that cast of characters changed over and over and over again. You know, Mr. Garrison had very little credibility by the end of all this.
Yeah, I interviewed him some years later when he did a book on all of this. And indeed, he seemed rather inventive still with regard to possible surreptitious plots, which only he had full knowledge of. But you are also suggesting, surely, though you can't finally assert this with definitive evidence, but you are suggesting, are you not, that the Cubans were probably involved in all of this and did set Oswald up somehow to carry through the act that he offered them, or maybe they, in fact, even had earlier recruited him to undertake the assassination?
I'm not sure I'm saying that. I am saying, though, that he goes to Mexico several weeks before the assassination, and he's in the company of Cubans and Mexican civilians who support Castro's revolution, who, dealing with this young former Marine who has rifle training at the height of the Cold War, the time when President Kennedy is very clearly trying to kill Fidel Castro, and Castro knows it, isn't it possible that somebody encouraged Oswald to do what he did or could have offered help if Oswald was able to carry out the deed and get back to Mexico? And that is not my crazy conspiracy theory. That is a theory that was developed within the staff of the Warren Commission. It didn't go into the Warren Commission final report because the decision was made that the report should not be speculative.
Actually, there's a quote from Lyndon Johnson suggesting that that Kennedy was assassinated because he was attempting to assassinate Castro, that the Cubans got to him before he got to Castro.
Well, it's pretty troubling to discover, you know, if you want to talk about conspiracy theorists, I guess you've got to include in that list President Johnson, the man who set up the Warren Commission, because by the time of his death, Johnson was apparently absolutely convinced that Castro had done it. And then you look at Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy, whose role in this is very troubling, start to finish. Robert Kennedy, who repeatedly says in the public record that he's convinced the Warren Commission was right, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, but who apparently to his friends and family said exactly the opposite. His own son, Robert Kennedy Jr., announced earlier this year that his father had always thought the Warren Commission was, I think the quote was, a shoddy piece of craftsmanship, and that he believed his brother had been killed either by Castro or by the mafia or by some rogue element of the CIA. And again, another conspiracy theorist apparently was Senator Richard Russell, this very powerful senator from Georgia, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who was a member of the Warren Commission itself, and who also believed that the Warren Commission got it wrong.
Of course, Russell himself was a very close associate of Lyndon Johnson, wasn't he?
I think he was arguably Lyndon Johnson's closest friend.
Yeah.
And you do wonder if President Johnson's suspicions about Castro might have been fed by his good friend, Senator Russell.
You know, now that I think of it, there were so many different hypotheses, so many different theories about the source of the assassination. There was one theory that was laid out in a play that some young woman wrote, which got a lot of attention for a few months, in which she made the ultimate culprit to be Lyndon Johnson himself.
Well, there's actually, I believe, a new book out that makes just that allegation.
Really?
By Roger Stone, the Republican political consultant.
Uh-huh. And of course, that's not
the first one. That rumor about Johnson being responsible for Kennedy's death. I mean, that was around from very shortly after the assassination, and that was for a time quite a popular theory, yeah, that somehow President Johnson and his powerful Texas political backers had some hand in the assassination.
Then another very popular theory, indeed a number of books have asserted this one, is that the mafia did it, or the mafia did it somehow in conjunction with Cuba or whatever. But particular people are named. Santos Traficante is one of them. Was he the mafia boss of either Miami or New Orleans? I forget.
He's in Florida. And the other fellow is a fellow by the name of Carlos Marcello.
Exactly, Marcello.
Who was the mob boss in New Orleans. And, you know, the thing about the allegations of mafia involvement is, I mean, there's a certain sense to them. The organized crime families in the United States had really come under assault for the first time by the government during the Kennedy administration.
In fact, the guy in New Orleans, Marcello, had been kicked out of the country by Robert Kennedy.
Right. I mean, these people, prominent members of organized crime in the United States, you know, that you can see where they might have had a motive to kill President Kennedy. But motive is very far from guilt. And you have to remember that, you know, both Oswald and Ruby were extremely unstable men. And there lacks a certain logic to the idea that the leaders of organized crime, which I think are seen as a very violent but rational bunch, would pick these two men to do such terrible things.
For yourself, you are, I gather, still persuaded that the actual act of assassination was done by Oswald.
You know, I think all the most credible evidence points to Oswald. We will never know with 100% certainty. And, you know, a lot of the ballistics evidence and other evidence gathered in Dealey Plaza, what you learn if you get a bit into this is that, you know, this science is really much more art than science.
What about the second shooter hypothesis developed by that later commission, a congressional committee, was it? I think both House and Senate represented thereupon. And they were convinced that there was evidence of a second shooter, probably at the Grassy Knoll.
Well, it gets a little complicated. So in the 1970s, the House of Representatives sets up a special committee to investigate the assassinations of President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, mm-hmm, to try to deal with all these conspiracy theories swirling around those three killings. And until the 11th hour of those investigations, the committee was prepared to essentially back up the Warren Commission, back up the single bullet theory, back up the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald had done this by itself. At the 11th hour, there's a tape recording that emerges apparently that a tape recording from a police radio recorded from a policeman's motorcycle, and it appears to suggest there were four shots fired in Dealey Plaza. And if there were four shots fired during the time frame that, this tape recorded, there must have been two shooters. And at the 11th hour, the House committee report is rewritten on the basis of this acoustical evidence to say there must have been a conspiracy. A very competent scientific analysis conducted thereafter showed that, the original finding about the tape was wrong, that the tape didn't show what it did, and that the acoustical evidence did not show two shooters. And if you go back through the materials, this vast library of evidence gathered by the House Assassinations Committee, they do largely back up the Warren Commission.
Are there people still alive who might know much, much more about who Oswald was, what motivated him, and whether he had connections through Mexico City or otherwise to the Cubans? Are there such people still around but not talking to us?
Well, I'm proud to say that there are some people who are still around and who talked to me for this book. With the help of a terrific Mexican researcher, we tracked down some of these people who should have been interviewed by the FBI and the CIA 49 years ago in Mexico City, but who weren't. And they to this day have memories of his encounters in Mexico City, encounters again with people who might well have wanted to see President Kennedy dead.
Well, let's look at that a bit more closely. There he is in Mexico City. How long does he hang around in town there?
6 days.
So what happens on day one, day two, on to day six?
Well, day one, he goes, it appears that he wants to get the paperwork that will allow him to travel to Cuba so he can defect there. He goes on the first day to the Cuban embassy and presents his paperwork and apparently fills out visa forms and the rest of it. And then he visits the Soviet embassy. It's a bit complicated, but he needs Soviet permission to get to Cuba. Both those embassies over the course of the next few days turn him down. They say they can't instantly provide him with the paperwork he needs, and indeed they may have been reluctant to give him the paperwork he needs. In fury, apparently, he makes the statement while in Mexico City, because he's so angry over the diplomatic morass between the United States and Cuba, that he makes the statement, "I'm going to kill Kennedy," and leaves the country in a fury and returns to Dallas, and 7 weeks later does what he does.
Who are some of the people you talked to who had information about the Mexico City visit?
Well, again, it's a bit complicated, but there is an important incident during Oswald's visit, apparently. He is seen in the company of a young Mexican woman who mm-hmm. works in the Cuban consulate in Mexico City at a dance party. One witness will come forward shortly after the assassination to say she saw Oswald at this party. She saw him with this woman from the consulate. And this was a party at which there were many Cubans and Mexicans sympathetic to the Castro Revolution and people who would have wanted to see John Kennedy dead. And the FBI and the CIA seemed determined not to learn what really happened about that party and what really happened. What I have been able to do over the last year is to find other people who remember that party and who remember at least one man who's remembered very clearly seeing Oswald there.
Another interesting angle that you develop the book, I should give its title more frequently as we talk, because it is truly a most engrossing account. If you are at all interested in American recent history and political history, you have to get your hands on A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination, by our guest, Philip Sheenon, and that is just published by, who is that, Harper?
Holt.
Holt. I beg your pardon. I don't have my reading glasses on.
No problem.
One other thing that comes up, and it was Gerald Ford who seems to have first broached this and spoken of it to some others who will ultimately report this to you, that maybe What ultimately provoked the Seoul assassination was not commitment to communist ideology, was not strong investment in the waging of the Cold War, was not resentment at his low estate in life on the part of Oswald, but rather could be traced to his sexual problems and his wife's contemptuousness towards his poor performance, one might say.
I thought this was fascinating because it is a theory that I think makes some sense, because if you look through the witness testimony and other evidence developed by the Warren Commission, many people knew, because Marina Oswald talked about it, about the sexual dysfunction in the marriage between her and Oswald. And Ford's theory, which would have been pretty provocative at the time, and so therefore he didn't talk about it publicly then, was that Oswald essentially wanted to, so angered over the humiliation his wife had put him through over his sexual performance, grabbed a rifle and decided to prove his masculinity by carrying out a very violent, terrible act.
We have that famous picture, don't we, of Oswald standing in the backyard, sort of brandishing that rifle.
Absolutely. Perhaps the most famous picture of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Hmm. Was that the actual rifle with which he did the assassination?
Apparently, he's got. I mean, that picture actually shows him holding the rifle, and in his he has a holster around his waist, and in that is a pistol, and that is the pistol he apparently used to kill Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, and it is apparently the rifle with which he used to kill President Kennedy.
Did your investigation also shed any light upon the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, the light that it was shed was just, again, how unstable was the man who killed Oswald, Jack Ruby, who runs a strip club in Dallas, and who seems to have been a very troubled man who was motivated principally by his love for President Kennedy and his fear that Jacqueline Kennedy would be forced to return to Dallas if there was a trial for Oswald. So Ruby decided to short-circuit that process by killing Oswald.
Well, that was the story he gave, to be sure. But others, again, pursuing a mafia connection, suggested that he was doing the hit for the mafia. The mafia, having hired or somehow supervised Oswald in the assassination of JFK, now had to be dispatched so that he would not reveal the mafia connection.
That is certainly the theory that Ruby was told or ordered to kill Oswald by his contacts in the mafia. I mean, one thing the record seems to show is that Ruby, he's raised on the tough streets of Chicago, and he'd always had some sort of low-level connection to organized crime figures, but he was nobody's definition of a mobster or a true organized crime figure. Also, the fact that if that was really the case, if the mafia had Ruby kill Oswald to silence him, it turns out that Ruby had a much better chance to do that just 2 days earlier. On Friday night, in the hours after the assassination, Ruby, with his pistol in his pocket, attends a news conference at which Oswald is displayed for reporters. You would have thought if he's really on orders to try the mafia to silence Oswald, he would have done it then, that Friday night, rather than wait 2 more days to do it on Sunday.
You know, when you look at the performance of the Dallas police, and when you look at the Dallas law enforcement people generally, then if you look at the performance of the FBI and the CIA and the Warren Commission itself, one great quotation comes to mind. I've used it before. It seems to be one of the great comments on how things go wrong or how things are seldom what they seem. The quotation is from Casey Stengel, who's coming off the field one day when the New York Mets, whom he was then managing, have yet lost another game. It was one of their worst seasons. And he's heard to mutter, "Don't nobody here know how to play this game?"
That is appropriate. That is appropriate.
And it looks like nobody at any of these agencies or at any of these collectivities really, maybe somebody did, but lots of people just didn't know what their obligations were and didn't have the skills requisite to those obligations.
I think that's true. I say, at the end of the day, incompetence often explains the malfunctions of government. And, the comparison I would make is with 9/11, where, of course, at the end of the day, it is just remarkable how much evidence the government had in the months before 9/11 that something like this was about to happen. And as it turns out, the same sort of story is true about the Kennedy assassination. The government had a tremendous amount of evidence to suggest that this young man was a threat to President Kennedy, and it should have been easy for them to roll him up.
And, of course, that's the connection between your two books, the earlier one about the 9/11 Commission and now the Warren Commission, which functioned earlier but has now, for the first time, been, in essence, closely analyzed and closely taken apart with regard to the day-by-day misdirection or simple incompetence that the commission itself seems to have demonstrated. I learned from your book that most of the staff members, those then young lawyers, had a fair amount of contempt or at least condescension towards Earl Warren himself.
Well, they thought they were... Well, we should point out that most of the commissioners, there were seven commissioners, most of them had almost nothing to do with the investigation. They never appeared for meetings. They never involved in witness interviews. They knew nothing about the basic facts. That the only people that, I mean, the Chief Justice was himself involved and Ford and to some extent Alan Dulles, the former director of Central Intelligence. The rest had very little to do with it.
So are you suggesting it was essentially a commission where most of its members were not really involved and just signed off on the final report?
I think that is largely true. And so that meant that most of the detective work, most of the real digging, was left to these young men, you know, then in their 20s or 30s or early 40s, most of whom had very little experience with the federal government, most of whom had never been any sort of investigator, most of whom who had never been involved in criminal law. And suddenly, in a matter of months, they had to determine, you know, how their president had died.
So don't nobody there know how to play that game?
There you go.
Then the staffing wasn't really very well done in itself, was it?
I'm sorry, Mr.
The staffing of the commission's assistance was not all that well executed in itself.
Well, it wasn't well. I mean, their idea was they were going to recruit nationally, and they were going to get the best and the brightest, and they did get, you know, a terrifically smart bunch of young lawyers who were very eager, who interestingly enough, most of whom came to Washington believing there was a conspiracy and eager to find the conspiracy. You know, I don't – the recruitment process – I think the my question about the recruitment process would be, why didn't you also try to find a few, real detective
– Of course.
People who had, right, criminal investigators or people with experience in national security affairs, and, you know, nothing like that.
Another misfunction or malfunction seems to be that lots of documents either were lost or disappeared or were never put forward into the commission's files, though they should have been. There seems to be a documentary confusion throughout the process.
I mean, that is a very big theme of my book, is just how much basic evidence is destroyed or disappears almost immediately after the assassination. You know, President Kennedy dies on Friday, November 22nd. That weekend, on Saturday night, you have the Navy pathologist who conducted the autopsy pushing the original autopsy report and all of his notes from the autopsy room into his home fireplace in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. Several hours after that, in Dallas, you have Dallas FBI agents tearing up a handwritten note that Oswald had left for them just a few weeks earlier. You know, what was in that note, we'll never know. And then that same weekend, you have Marina Oswald putting a match to these photographs that show her husband holding the assassination rifle. Again, that's just the first weekend of evidence destruction. It goes on and on and on in the weeks that follow.
Now, is that simply accountable by incompetence, or might there be some sort of manipulative presence involved in fostering this way of destroying evidence?
Well, you know, the answer is we'll never know, because I can't
another one
you
of the many things we'll never know.
Well, I can tell you that, for example, the pathologist who destroys the autopsy report, his explanation later is that he saw the notes and the original autopsy report stained with the president's blood, and he was very worried that these would turn up someday as some sort of grisly souvenir of the assassination. He wanted to prevent that, and the way to prevent that was to push him into his fireplace and watch them turn to ash. But when the commission's lawyers found out about that, they thought, oh my goodness, and this is just the start. This is how conspiracy theories are born, that something was destroyed, something important was destroyed when the pathologist destroyed the autopsy report.
Who comes through with flying colors, or at least who comes through with honor in this whole process?
I think most of these young lawyers on the Warren Commission staff, they work their hearts out. They work to the point of physical collapse. They would have been eager to find a conspiracy if one existed. They didn't know what they were up against, though, in agencies like the FBI and the CIA, which were determined to hide from them the full truth.
I guess one does have to zero in, if only for a moment, on J. Edgar Hoover as a very significant figure in this whole story. He never ran an open and available FBI when it came to disclosing what they were up to. And surely he was the ultimate manipulator in that he stayed in power by what he had on various other high officials, including presidents of the United States, what he had particularly on them with regard to their sexual extracurricular activities. How do we account for his performance in relation to Earl Warren? I gather that they each sort of despise the other as well.
They detested each other, and there's some fantastic paperwork, and fantastic maybe the wrong adjective, but there's some remarkable paperwork in Hoover's files that documents just how much he despised Earl Warren.
For what qualities, by the way?
Well, because Earl Warren had come to the Supreme Court and started writing opinions at the court that began to severely limit the powers of the FBI, that expanded the rights of criminal defendants. Warren was obviously a champion of the civil rights and civil liberties movements, which were diametrically opposed to the way J. Edgar Hoover saw the world.
Yeah.
But J. Edgar Hoover, from within 48 hours of President Kennedy's assassination, J. Edgar Hoover, in his own mind, has decided that Oswald did it. He did it alone. There's no conspiracy to uncover. There's really not much to investigate. And that becomes the mindset of the FBI. And much of my book is this war between J. Edgar Hoover and the Warren Commission.
It's a very strange tale, really. But I think you're right when you suggest that if you really uncovered the works and ways of many sectors of our bureaucracy, including the higher political sector of our commanding that bureaucracy, you find an awful lot of sheer incompetence or inattentiveness rather than intended evil.
I think that's true. And, so many of the crises, national security, economic, you name it, that we've gone through in the last several years, often comes just down to people who aren't so bright having access to the levers of power.
Yeah, sometimes even through election.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Right. So what's left with regard to the question of what the assassination was really about? Are there in your own mind still some haunting possibilities that you examine and brood about but can't finally come to a decision on?
Well, there are many things that I really can't come to a decision on. I think I'm optimistic, though, that we may be able to get some additional answers. One question that the Warren Commission entirely ducked was the question of Oswald's real motives for killing the president. I think there may be people in Mexico City still alive who he may have had conversations with, suggesting, they may have known what he was talking about doing and why he was talking about doing it. And there are also still some secret documents involving the assassination that are at the National Archives waiting to be declassified in years to come.
What documents would those be?
Well, apparently it's a small number, but there are, and again, this is my speculation, and I probably shouldn't get involved in speculation, but there are some documents that the government has withheld on national security grounds, and my assumption is that they somehow involve agents, intelligence agents working overseas who are still alive, whose lives might be in danger if it was revealed they had worked for the CIA, for example.
Hmm. I learn, again, this is really quite startling, that Fidel Castro did submit to questioning by an employee from the commission. went down to Cuba, and they went on to, I guess, Castro's yacht, and they spoke for 3 hours or so. What came of that?
That's an amazing story, but Castro was adamant publicly after the assassination that he had nothing to do with it, that this wasn't any Cuban conspiracy. And he apparently sent word to the Warren Commission that he was willing to be questioned. And in those days, Fidel Castro was, he was the devil. The United States government and any sort of official part of the United States government could not be seen conversing with Fidel Castro. But the Warren Commission apparently decided it still wanted to question him if it had the opportunity. So a very secret mission was set up for one of the young staff lawyers, a guy by the name of William Coleman, who was actually sent out on a boat to the waters off Cuba, where he meets up with Castro, who's on his yacht. And Coleman boards the yacht, and they talk for 3 hours, and Castro again adamantly denies he had anything to do with the assassination. And it's a wonderful story, if only because Coleman knew Castro. That may be why he was chosen for the mission, because Coleman knew Castro from the jazz clubs of Harlem, where apparently Castro used to like to go when he visited New York in the 40s and 50s.
Huh. They're wonderful. And was he himself persuaded that Castro was innocent of any complicity in the whole affair?
Coleman is a very cautious lawyer, and I think the way he describes it, he came back to the Warren Commission and said, I can't say he didn't do it, but I can't see any evidence that he did do it.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't advance the issue very much, does it?
Well, he said, if Coleman had come back and said, I really think he's lying, then maybe there would have been a more aggressive investigation of Castro's connections to all this.
Do you see any major lies done by intention in the whole process? Is anybody lying to the commission?
Absolutely, over and over again. I mean, beginning with Hoover. Hoover purges himself. He lies under oath about what went on at the FBI before and after the assassination. And Marina Oswald's widow, repeatedly lies to the Warren Commission under oath. She and other government agencies. She initially denies she had any knowledge of other murder plots her husband was thinking about. She denied she had any knowledge of this Mexico City trip that her husband had taken. All of that would later be shown to be a lie.
Of course, actually, we now know, don't we, and we knew a long time ago, that Oswald had also tried to kill, what's the name of that general down there in Texas?
Yeah, Edwin Walker.
Yeah.
He attempts to, there's this far-right retired Army general by the name of Edwin Walker, and Oswald, in April 1963, apparently tries to shoot him by firing his rifle into Walker's home. He misses, and he tells his wife about this, Marina. And after the assassination of President Kennedy, Marina initially denies any knowledge of the Walker shooting. Later on, she admits she did know all about it.
So where do you come out? Where do you finally stand on all of this? Would you, with what probability would you agree, or with what degree of doubt would you agree that probably it was undertaken by Oswald and Oswald alone, rather than any other group or person backing him and assisting him?
Well, I think you will understand that I'm wary of coming out too firmly. I think where I come out is, as an American citizen, pretty appalled just how much of this story, 50 years later, we still haven't been told, and how much effort there has been over these 50 years to destroy vital evidence that might have pointed in different directions.
Well, you certainly draw that portrait of the inefficiency of, or worse, of both agencies, the CIA and the FBI, and you certainly also make clear that the Warren Commission was hardly a group of dedicated investigators at the top, though there were some very dedicated investigators on the staff. Do you think before we're done with all of this, I mean, in coming decades, we'll ever get any more real purchase on the true story or the ultimate story?
I have some optimism that if somebody serious went to Mexico, they might find more people who were dealing with Oswald in those critical weeks just before the assassination, people who he would have seen as sympathetic, who he might have shared more information with. And there is this material in the National Archives that may shed some additional light. I do think at the end of the day, this is a morass. This is, you know, we're never going to be able to dig ourselves fully out of the confusion over this story because so many people have made the effort over the years to make sure we were confused at the end of this story.
Well, I guess they succeeded.
They did.
In confusing us. But you've done a great deal to dispel that confusion. And I thank you most sincerely for joining us today and also for this fine book, which I'm happy to recommend to any and all assassination buffs or many and any who really care about what goes right and what goes wrong in the functioning of the important sectors of the national government. The book by Philip Sheenon, by the way, that's spelled S-H-E-N-O-N, is titled A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.